Radio.
At Ireland's Classic Hits Radio, we're ready to get the gang back together this summer.
Our famous listener parties are back.
And our first stop is the one and only Cork City. Get ready to party on June 13th with Trina Mara, Damien Farrelly, Colm Hayes and Lucy Kennedy,
along with Cork's own Dave Mack and more of your favourite presenters.
There'll be food and drinks and the chance to win amazing prizes.
It's all happening at the Voodoo Rooms and Pop Scene, Cork's number one late night venue.
Do you voodoo?
Want to be there? Then keep it here. We'll have tickets to win starting Monday morning on Ireland's Classic Hits Radio, the home of the 80s and 90s.
Enjoy a truly unique getaway and explore Inishmore on the Aran Islands. Stay in one of our sea view bedroom chalets on the elevated grounds of the hotel, overlooking Killeany Bay and Kilronan Harbour. Experience Inishmore and the island way of life with a two-night digital detox during midweek break that's guaranteed to recharge your batteries. All for €75 B&B per person sharing per night at the Aran Islands Hotel. Call Aran Islands Hotel on 099-611-04 to book.
Hungary, your destination for affordable smiles. Access Smile provides quality dental care without compromise. At our clinic in Budapest, our advanced dental technology has provided thousands of clients with countless smiles, from mouth reconstruction to dental implants, crowns, bridges and veneers. Access Smile also provides assessment and aftercare right here in Ireland. Craft your picture-perfect smile affordably at access-smile.ie.
You're listening to Nighttime Talk
with Recruit.ie, Ireland's new online job search. Search for your dream job today on Recruit.ie.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio. Nighttime Talk. Call us now on 0818 942 105.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
Hi, I'm Megan Scully, and this is Crack August Kuehl on Ireland's Classic Hits Radio. Emile Nigat Nocha Tho, foremost and toast album of Billy Ray Cyrus. August Vian Tauron, Achey Break Your Heart, Le Fall Air. Don Shay bore on Billboard, Rochade, Erfa, Shach Zeg Shachana. Freshen, Emile Nigat Nocha Tho, Rogan Tauroni, Sam Smith in London. Emile Nigat Octo Hoch, foremost album Ever It's Eh, Owen Tauroni, Prince. I'm going down. Ghadil is a she, Vui Lordi on Eurovision. Isas on Inlan Atoshi. That's Crack August Kuehl on Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
Across Cork, Limerick, Clare, and Galway.
On your phone.
And on your smart speaker.
This is the home of the 80s and 90s.
This is Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
It's 11 o'clock. Good evening. I'm Joe Caulfield. The Taoiseachs describe plans for the provision of large-scale tented accommodation for asylum seekers at Thornton Hall as logical. The site in North Dublin was previously earmarked for a prison. Simon Harris says the provision of state accommodation remains extremely challenging. Meanwhile, there are now over 80 tents pitched by asylum seekers along the Grand Canal in Dublin city centre. CEO of migrants' rights organisation Duras, John Lannan, says we need to accommodate the influx of migrants, but the needs of local businesses should also be taken into account.
We expect to see up to 16,000 people seeking international protection here annually now, or that's what the government are expecting as well. We can handle that, you know, but we do need to handle it in a way that doesn't affect businesses negatively.
Some Gardaí will start wearing body cameras within weeks. Representative groups have long campaigned for the devices to help improve members' safety. They're set to be rolled out on a pilot basis first and then across the force next year. Justice Minister Helen McEntee has been speaking at the opening of a new Garda station in An Spidéal, County Galway today, which she says represents her commitment to policing.
It's just part of a series of investments that are taking place across the country, where we are investing in Garda stations, where we are increasing the number of Gardaí that we have across the country, where we're investing in our Garda fleet, we're investing in technology, and in the coming weeks we will have for the first time body cameras on our Gardaí, making sure that we can keep them safe but also that it supports the work that they do. So this is a clear commitment.
Gardaí are making an appeal after an e-scooter driver was injured in a hit and run crash in Dublin. The man in his 40s were driving an e-scooter which collided with a car in Ballybock shortly after 11 o'clock on Tuesday night, and the car failed to stop. The man was taken to the Mater Hospital for treatment of non-life-threatening injuries. The motorist has yet to come forward. Finally for now, Donald Trump's former lawyer has admitted surreptitiously recording a conversation with his client so he could share it with a third party. At Mr. Trump's hush money trial, Michael Cohen agreed it wasn't ethical before admitting he has almost 100 secret recordings on his phone, including of journalists. The former US president denies claims he faked records to hide payments to the actress. That's it for now. We'll have more in an hour.
Ireland's weather.
With McCarthy Insurance Group. For better value, home, farm, motor, life, health and business insurance in 2024. MIG.ie.
Tonight, outbreaks of heavy and thundery rain will affect parts of Leinster and Munster, but it will be mainly dry elsewhere with a mix of cloud and clear spells. Lowest temperatures of 9 to 12 degrees. And now you're up to date on the home of What Did Lucy Kennedy Say to Colm Hayes? Weekday mornings on Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
Now, Nighttime Talk on the home of the 80s and 90s.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
Now, something very, very interesting coming up in about 10 minutes' time. I've got one of Canada's top journalists. He's on to talk about a book he wrote not too long ago, and he believes that America is on the brink of civil war. More on that coming up in a moment. Now, just a little gripe I have. Just been out making a cup of tea outside in our kitchen here. And these cardboard milk cartons with the tops that no longer come off. So the milk pours all over the place. It doesn't actually get into the mug. It goes all over the surface of the kitchen. Does any of you agree that's just a kind of a headache? Tommy or Martin?
Yeah, it's... sorry, Tommy, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Martin, because I don't really...
That's just you know, placating Eamon Ryan. That's all that is. Mm. And that ties into something I was going to mention.
Yeah.
I think I said to you before, Gareth, I'm the quintessential grumpy old man, right? I am Victor Meldrew, you know, incarnate.
I would never have guessed, but I'm delighted that you choose to be on the show with us.
But when it comes to things like Amazon and that, every purchase you make is tracked.
Yeah.
Pardon me. And they keep a record of it. Now, you get the same with supermarkets. That's why when I purchase, I use cash. I never use my debit card.
Oh.
On any purchase, I never use my debit card. I don't sign up for any loyalty cards or anything else. I don't want anybody tracking my purchases. And if I lose out on a deal because, oh, you get a discount on this if you're a member of our club, I don't want to be a member of your club. I came in here to do a transaction. I don't want to be a member of your club. I don't want you tracking anything I'm purchasing. I don't want junk mail arriving in my letterbox or emails arriving. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to take part in any of that. And if I am King Canute trying to hold back the tide, fair enough. You know, I live with that. As I say, I'm that quintessential grumpy old man. And that suits me. That's who I am. And I make no apologies for it.
But Martin, the reason that they ask you to do that is so that they can stock their shelves with the products that you want.
That's a good point.
So,
yeah.
No.
The reason they do that is so that they can sell you the product that they want to sell you.
That's what they're there for, Martin. Let's be honest about it. But Tommy,
you just said so that they can stock the shelves with products that you want.
Let me explain it to you, because this is what happens, right? When you have a loyalty card, for example, and if you change one of the products that you're buying, say marmalade, you stop using the one with the rind in it and you start using the one without the rind in it, and you go into the supermarket and they only have the one with the rind in it, that means that they don't know. But they do know because they have a loyalty card. Let me tell you, this is the truth. Let me explain something to you, Martin, right? There was a radio producer in America, and an irate man rang in to complain to him that his daughter had been sent things that would be sent free of charge from one of the big supermarkets to a lady that would be expecting a child. And he was annoyed. Because he thought, you know, his daughter wasn't married and she was quite young and this and that. But by the following week, he had to ring back in, because he was an honest man, he did, to apologise because he was pregnant.
Oh. That's, yeah. Just come back on that for a minute, Tommy.
So what you're saying to me there, Martin, is, right?
So are you saying,
I do see your point.
Are you saying she could have been buying online for the baby, say, or for her pregnancy, and the only people who knew she was pregnant was the technology that was tracking her?
Exactly.
You've just made my point.
Wow. That's
You've just made my point.
That's the case. But, Martin...
Yeah, sorry, Tommy, hang on for a second.
You're not letting me finish.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm going to say to you. So, you've changed your choice of marmalade to the one without the rind in it. And you go into the supermarket and they don't have it. Are you going to go back there again, or will you go to the other supermarket and buy it there?
Okay. First off, Tommy, you've just made my point that these people track your purchases, okay? And they know more about you than you think you do.
Martin, it's not just your purchases they track. They nearly know how much you have in your pocket.
Yeah, that's my point. Now, when it comes to knowing what goods are being sold and what goods aren't being sold, as I said, I have a very close... My job keeps me in very, very close relationship with a major retailer in this country, and I know managers all over the country. And I can tell you, they know which products are selling, are not selling, and which are in demand and not in demand, simply by how fast they move off the shelf. Whether a person has a loyalty card or anything else, they don't need that in the shop. They know.
The point that you're missing here is...
I'm not missing the point. I've got your point.
When you put your groceries into the checkout, the machine that most people use now instead of going through the thing, how do they know? Wait to hear this. This is very interesting. How do they know if you've changed the barcode to the cheaper product?
I don't understand the point you made. Change the barcode to the cheaper product.
How would you change the barcode?
Say, for example, you go in to...
I mean, that you switch the labels?
Yeah, people do it, you know. People do it. It's a form of shoplifting. How do they know, Martin? How do they know that you've done that?
You know, they know when they do stock reconciliation. I deal with loss prevention.
They know straight away, Martin. They know straight away, Martin. And do you know how they know?
How?
The way of the product.
Eddie is there. How are you, Eddie?
That's fine if you're going through the... That's fine if you're going through the self-checkouts. But the vast majority of people don't. My point is, you just made my point in the story you told about the girl who was pregnant. My point is that any manager that I know knows which products are selling and which aren't. That's why when you go into certain supermarkets...
But sure, it'd be the same, Mark. You're not Mossad. You know what I mean? When you go in and buy something off your butcher and he notices that you buy oxtail a lot, he'll probably stock oxtail, so it'll be there for you.
Because I'm going in, I'm buying it.
Yeah. Hang on a sec. I want to bring Eddie in because Eddie's been waiting since before 11 o'clock. Good evening to you, Eddie.
Good evening, Gareth. You well?
I'm good, thanks. Good conversation going on, but I just want to try and draw it back to the nub of the issue. We're talking about people's interest in online shopping and whether it's going to eventually sort of dominate all forms of shopping, because it's certainly getting to a stage now where, as I mentioned, Stephen King says in that great thriller he wrote 3 years ago, Billy Summers, he says you can buy anything online. Do you do a lot of online shopping?
No, I'd be in my late 40s, so I'd probably be the last generation that would actually go into the high street. I don't buy anything online. I got stung years ago buying a jacket online. And what the advertised was completely different to what arrived.
Yeah.
And the whole process of packaging it and sending it back and going through all that, I just end up binning it. I thought, I'll just take the hit of about €60. Can't be done with it. I'm one of them. I like to try something on. Now, there'll be times I'd go out into a shop, and if I see something that I like, because I'm actually seeing it, I'll actually Google it online there and then in front of me. And if it's cheaper online, No, it'd have to be a few quid cheaper for me to go through the hassle, but if it was only one or two, I wouldn't. But if it was 5 or 10 quid cheaper, and the product I'm looking at holding in my hands, I can get online cheaper, then I'll buy it.
Mm.
I mean, we're in a cost of living crisis, so, for example, I used to shop at Dunnes, and a bottle of a box of Rice Krispies would be about 5 quid. I'd go around the corner to Aldi, the same box, 500 grams, 150. Yeah. It's the same product, just different packaging. So you're going to be smart with your money.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'll tell you a story now how I got a discount, because I'd be quite cheeky, you know. And I went to a well-known electrical shop in Dublin, and I was buying something that was nearly a grand, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I looked around the shop, and I was looking for a member of staff, a young lad that'd be kind of Jack the Lad, that'd be willing to take a risk, right? And I walked up to this fella and said, can I ask you a question? He says, go on. I said, how much of a staff discount do you get? He says, 10%. I said, well, I'm buying something there that's a grand. I said, so if you buy that for me, I'll give you 50 quid. I say 50 quid and he got 50 quid. You don't ask, you don't get. You know what I mean? What can he do? He can only say no. And he made 50 quid there and then. And I just said, just say I'm your uncle and I'm bringing it home for you. You're buying it. And he went, yeah, sound. I said, there you go. There's 50 euro. Happy days.
Del boy.
You know what I mean? He can only turn around and say no.
Good idea, though.
That's brilliant.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Hats off.
Now, I'll tell you another thing what I used to do when I used to live in England. Right, you'll go mad at this because it is a form of theft. I used to bring my own stapler in the shop. And when I'd go in to get a pair of diesel jeans, I'd take two pairs into the dressing room. I'd take off the label from this jean that I want, which is 100 quid. And I'd get the other one that's 70 quid and I'd staple it on. And I'd go up to the counter, talk to your woman, there you go. She'd scan it, happy days. Done. You know?
That's slightly dishonest, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, oh, it's 100% dishonest. It's 100% dishonest, but it is, but it works. It's the same way when you said there about swapping the labels on the discount shelves. We've been at that for years. For years. Pulling one label off, putting it on the other product, and walking up to the counter, picking the dough-eyed little girl that hasn't a clue, and sweet talk, hey, you love, and just watching her scan the stuff. Happy days. I'm out of shop. Saved a few bob. It's
you
all about.
Don't put it through the self checkout because they.
No, I don't, and that's why I said to you straight at the off. It's all about the weight, you know.
I just told everybody
in the
whole
savvy.
World that they're on the supermarket.
Yeah, you have to be savvy. But I mean, it's all about getting bang for your buck. Now I will say we're
hold,
the last.
Hold on, I'm writing this down. Don't be so fast. Hold on.
I would say in the next 20 years, everything, because my generation and lads older than me are the last generations that are keeping the high street alive.
Yeah.
When that footfall goes, because all the young generation buy online, ASOS, Temu, Amazon, all of that. And when our generation die off, it'd be a barren wasteland going into town. Mm. You know?
I know.
Have you noticed how much Temu are actually advertising at the moment?
Lads, I have to go. I'm in work, all right?
Okay, Eddie, by the way, I have a 38-inch waist. Oh, sorry. Okay. Lads, I'm going to have to leave it there, but I don't think you're going to be disappointed by the gentleman I'm going to be speaking to in a minute. He's a great journalist. He's a fantastic author as well. And thanks to both of you, Tommy and Martin and Eddie, and also to Jessica. We're going to take a break. It's a book I mentioned actually about 2 weeks ago on the show. It's called The Next Civil War, and it's by a Canadian writer called Stephen Marsh. And he's going to join me on the line from Canada in a couple of moments' time. If you'd like to take part in the conversation, the number is 087-188-0008.
Nighttime Talk. Call us now on 0818-942-105.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
Previously on Colm and Lucy in the Morning.
Margaret, are you joking?
No, this is not a joke.
It's not a joke, people.
Colm mightn't like it.
Oh, no. Now you've piqued my interest.
We're thinking, how many times have you dyed your hair?
Hey, back off there. Oh my God, all morning we were trying to get Lucy to laugh. That's all I'm doing.
Margaret wants
Once
to know the truth.
In my life, because of you.
Twice.
Once.
The first time you went orange.
Colm and Lucy in the Morning. Weekdays from 6 a.m. with Noyx Newmans. For your kitchens, floors, decks and doors.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
Girls, it's time for a Gertie breakaway. At the Talbot Hotel, Clonmel, County Tipperary, we've got you sorted. From an unbelievable €139 per person sharing, we've got an all-inclusive girly overnight getaway. with breakfast, afternoon tea, bubbles, chocolates, cocktail, dinner, swimming pool, gym and more. Book your perfect girly getaway now at talbothotelclonmel.ie.
Captains and convicts, saints and sinners, and 1,300 years of Irish history are awaiting you at Spike Island Cork. Ireland's infamous prison island is just waiting to be explored, so book your adventure for 2024. Spike Island Cork. Discover it for yourself. Tickets include your ferry crossing, guided tours, and so much more. So check opening hours, plan your visit, and head back in time at spikeislandcork.ie.
Listening to Nighttime Talk
with Recruit.ie, Ireland's new online job search. Search for your dream job today on Recruit.ie.
Ireland's classic hits radio.
Now, welcome back. Just gone 20 minutes past 11. I'm going to have a conversation with Stephen Marsh, the author, in a couple of moments' time. I just want to draw your attention, those of you of a certain age. If you're kind of, I suppose, in the late 50s, early 60s or older, you'll remember our very own Bloody Friday. And that was the day of the Dublin Monaghan bombings. And it's tomorrow, 50 years ago, 17th of May, 1974. The early years of the Troubles, they'd made violence a daily occurrence all over the north of Ireland. But on the 17th of May, 1974, that violence came to the streets of Dublin and to the beautiful, small, tranquil town of Monaghan, in what proved to be the greatest loss of life in a single day over the course of the entire conflict. And there are a load of articles, lots of very, very interesting, insightful articles in all of the newspapers tomorrow that I would recommend to keep an eye out for. And there's lots of stuff as well online. Just about memories of those particular days from people who are still alive but remember them vividly. Some of them remembering them almost as if they were yesterday. Some of them remembering family members and relatives who died in the bombings. 34 people were killed in four separate bombings in Dublin and Monaghan. And I'm looking at the front page of the Irish Independent on the 18th of May. That was the Saturday, 1974. Our Bloody Friday was the front page headline. Perhaps a nod to the events of Bloody Friday in 1972, when 20 IRA bombs exploded in just over an hour across Belfast City. Death shattered three crowded rush hour streets in Dublin yesterday evening when car bombs snuffed out the lives of at least 23 people, leaving more than 100 maimed and mutilated, the front page lead read. And the newspaper, the Irish Independent, today carries that front page photograph. Darren Nolan writing an article on it on page 8. Now, we'll come back to that next week because, things are kind of so busy at the moment, you tend to kind of forget dates and memories and particular remembrances and anniversaries and that. So we will come back to that next week on the show. Now, as I mentioned, a book we talked about on the show last week, in fact, it was called The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future. And Canadian novelist and cultural commentator Stephen Marsh is the author of this book. It's a book, and I've read a lot of books on recent American politics and the state of the United States, which, let's face it, is not united any longer. And this is one of the finer, finer books that I've read in relation to what's going on. But not just that, Stephen anticipates what's likely to happen if what's going on right now continues to happen. And he joins me on the line from his home in Canada right now. Stephen, great to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you too, Gareth.
This is an extraordinary book on so many levels, and I'm not quite sure where to start. It's not an interview per se, it's a conversation I want to have with you about it, because I wrote a little about the book and I talked a lot about it over the last couple of weeks here on the show. And one of the things you say about the book, The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future, is that you don't think anything is inevitable. You say, I try to be very specific in the book about the odds of things happening, how strong the models are, because I don't think you need to exaggerate anything here to be scared out of your wits. Really, the message that I got from the book is that what's happening now is no longer repairable. You can't just say things will sort itself out the way America is at the moment will eventually go back to the way we always remember it being, because it was never that way. Isn't that the case?
Well, I don't know about it not being repairable. I mean, what I would say, you know, what I tried to do in the book was show the best available models and show where they're tending and where they're going. And for what I do believe is that if they don't take steps to change their future, these models will, in fact, you know, just become inevitable. But, you know, I would also say that America is the great country of change, right? I mean, it's the great country of political change. It's the great country of personal change. I mean, you know, they invent religions and they invent, you know, various forms of total insanity all the time. You know, if any country can escape where it is headed, it would be the United States. On the other hand, I will say I see no effort whatsoever to pull back from the hyperpartisanship and the increases in violence and the general tendency towards, you know, political chaos that I think is pretty evident in the United States right now.
Yeah. Now, I'm very fortunate to have been a regular visitor over the years to New York. And I would imagine it's probably about 2.5 years since I visited New York. But I would imagine if I was to visit it tomorrow, I wouldn't actually see much that's different to what I saw 2 years ago, would I?
I feel like America changes every time I go to see it. And I mean, I'm there all the time, right? Like I was there 2 weeks ago. I live in Toronto. I'm there pretty regularly. I mean, it is darker than I remember it even 3 years ago, and less optimistic and less, and more afraid. Mm-hmm. You know, I think like, you know, in the time that happened, the abortion, the changes to the abortion laws took place, and that has really changed the mood for a lot of people in the United States. I mean, I think the mood, even in New York, which of course is not, you know, is very separate from the rest of the United States, I think that you can actually feel that kind of darkening of the mood.
Mm. Now, most people seem to believe, from a distance anyway, that Donald Trump was central to everything that has happened in the last couple of years. But that's not the case. As you say in the book, Donald Trump is at most a symptom of the problems in America.
I mean, I think that's the most controversial. The thing I was attacked most about in the book is where I said if Hillary Clinton had been elected rather than Donald Trump, everything I wrote in this book would still be true. I mean, I think when you look at the deeper trends, the hyperpartisanship, the spiking inequality, I mean, you know, America has more horizontal and vertical inequality now than it has had since 1776, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it is at really extreme levels. And then when you include into that, you know, the gun ownership question, the environmental catastrophes that keep happening. It is a textbook case of a country headed for civil war.
Yeah, very much so. And in fact, I don't know whether you got to read Paul Theroux's marvelous book, Deep South, where he travels.
No, I've never read that.
Oh, it's a fantastic book. And I really do recommend it to you. He talks to impoverished communities that are reeling from the OxyContin scandal, and they really don't really have a hope of pulling their lives together. But yet, their deep belief in the American Constitution is what really keeps them going, as they say. And you say that in the book.
Well, to me, as a Canadian, it was really one of the weirdest things about the whole thing, because everywhere you go in America, without exception, this incredibly divided country, everyone worships the Constitution. I mean, you go and talk to a Texas nationalist, right? Like a person who wants Texas to separate from the United States. He worships the Constitution. I mean, you know, I live in a country with a separatist movement. Like, Quebec separatists do not worship the BNA Act, right? Like, they're not interested in, like, upholding the core constitutional values of Canada. They want their own constitution, right? Like, and then at the same time, like, never mind Texas nationalists, if you go to, like, a New York Times journalist, an opinion, they regard it as a sacred text, which they treat with, you know, with elaborate commentaries. And I found it because the other thing that's so obvious is that it's an 18th century document. I mean, it's a work of great genius, but it's a broke, like it's just a non-functioning document anymore. Nobody knows what it means. Like it's meaning was from a different century. And so, you know, when you have a document that you worship as sacred, that's fundamentally non-functional, you don't get practical government. You know, that's not like, and the great irony, of course, is that the U.S. Constitution was the ultimate document against that kind of worship, right? Yeah. It was the ultimate statement of, like, you know, politics for people rather than for God or, you know, your ancestors or whatever, like just for like people living their lives. And it's become this kind of ghostly, you know, it's this ghost that stalks them. Yeah. I mean, it's a terrible irony.
Yeah, it was what led to the land of the free. Isn't that the case? As many Americans would like to have thought.
I mean, I think, you know, it is a great, like, I'm not saying anything against the U.S. Constitution. It's a great Enlightenment document. I mean, it is a document saying, you know, government should be for people. It should not be for, you know, representatives of God or representatives of some ancient history. It should be for, like, how do we make people's lives better, right? Mm. And that's a hugely powerful statement. It's just that when you get to the details of how it works, you're dealing with an 18th century document that, like, has not, you know, no longer serves that function. And Jefferson himself was very clear about that. I mean, Jefferson said a constitution should last no longer than 19 years, yeah, right? Because otherwise it's a contract with the dead. And that's exactly what they have, a contract with the dead.
Mm-hmm. Recent figures, fairly recent, I think in the last 12 months, say that almost 40% of Americans and a very large number of very pro-Trump supporters believe that the United States is on the cusp of a civil war. And many of them say, Stephen, that they feel that the civil war never really ended, and really a second go at it would probably bring it to its logical conclusion.
Well, I mean, I remember one of the very first people who interviewed me was some, like, you know, relatively right-wing American organization. And one of the first questions he asked me was, do you think a civil war would be so bad? And I was like, the last one, yeah. I mean, the last one you had, like, 3% of your population died. Like, there has to be a better way. Like, there has to be a better way than slugging it out with guns. Like, that cannot be the correct way to do politics. I think one of the things that's really, you know, that you feel in America is this will to violence, yeah, right? Like, they want the violence. And, of course, I think that's really so dangerous and awful and blind and an indictment of our time and of our generation. Mm. You know, that they would actively want violence. I mean, that's ignorance of a completely epic scale.
I'm speaking to Stephen Marsh, and this is a book we spoke about last week here on the show, The Next Civil War: Dispatches from the American Future. There are five scenarios at the heart of the book, Stephen. One scenario, I kind of quite liked this guy. I don't know who he was. He described, you describe in the book, this is the local sheriff who refuses an order from the federal government to close an unsafe bridge, leading him basically to become a hero to fringe movements and conspiracy theorists. It's a story, but yet it's truth, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, I did have to throw out chapters of this book because they kept happening, right? And and that is honest to God, like, there was a period where I was like, am I just gonna not be able to publish this because it's gonna happen?
Yeah.
The vanity of authors, like, you know, is the end of America gonna ruin my book deal? Like, classy Stephen. But there have been incidents like, you know, everything in the book is based on real stuff. Mm. Like, there are these projections, but, like, you know, I mean, the sheriff that I imagined there, like, you don't have to imagine him. You can absolutely go and find several people very similar to him, just in a slightly different scenario. But it was, I mean, Eagle Pass, I mean, obviously that was with the Texas state government rather than a county sheriff.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was a governor of a state basically denying that the federal government had authority over the national borders. Right. And it was absolutely done for media stunt reasons, right, for this rhetorical gamesmanship with the federal government, because he knew that it would just increase his popularity to resist the federal government. just today, he pardoned the guy who ran over Black Lives Matter protesters in his car, Texas governor. So you're getting more and more explicit talk and actions that express that are resistance to federal authority, right? And that's, I mean, you know, those have all been talked down from the edge, but I don't think it's actually very hard to imagine them taking on a military dimension.
Mm. And one of the things I was very interested, one of the many things is the fact that the Republicans and the Democrats, while they've never seen eye to eye on the majority of issues, they now can't even agree on fundamental facts.
Oh, no. I mean, there are no facts in America anymore. There is no such thing as consensus reality in the United States. I mean, that is like if you drive from Chicago an hour south, you are in two different sets of realities. Like, I mean, like I don't think that has to do with Democrat or Republican. I think that's just like that's actually something that's happened in the country. The political class is responding. I mean, that's why I say that Trump really doesn't, you know, like blaming Trump sounds fun and it makes you comfortably imagine that if he's defeated, then all of this will go away. But, you know, there are absolutely multiple realities in the United States. I mean, huge portions of the United States believe that the 2020 election was illegitimate.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, I think it's still around 80% of Republicans. Like, it's a significant number of registered Republicans. The vast majority believe the 2020 election was stolen. So you're already in a position where the legitimacy of the government is not a consensus reality.
Mm.
That's already happened.
What happens, Stephen, if Trump is reelected? I recall many years ago here in Ireland, when Donald Trump first appeared on the scene, and he was no longer a television star, he was now a budding politician and about to become president of the United States. People were appalled. The majority of people were appalled. And I remember actually suggesting on radio that maybe we should give this guy a go.
Right.
And I almost lost my job. But yet now... Almost 20% of Irish voters said that they would, if they could, vote to have Donald Trump re-elected as president. Does that surprise you?
That's amazing.
You? Yeah.
Well, not really. I mean, I think the force of polarization is very intense, and it's coming for everybody. I mean, I thought Canada was immune, but it's coming here too. And, like, I mean, it's slower. But it's – and, you know, I mean, the right-wing swing in Europe is also a part of this process, right, that I think is coming where you have this hyper-polarization. You have what they call complementary radicalization, where the left gets crazier and the right gets crazier and everyone in the middle gets ignored. And, I mean, I think that's happening in a lot of different political systems. I mean, the thing is, in America – they don't, unlike Ireland and Canada and most other democracies, they don't really have a civil service that's permanent the way that we do, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason I wrote this book is because I went to cover the inauguration for a Canadian magazine, and a fellow journalist said, come to this party. It was in Georgetown. And I went to this party, and a guy had just come from the Food and Drug Administration, low-level bureaucrat. You know, the guy who's responsible for the price of wheat in like 2050. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he had all the presidential portraits on his wall, and he'd taken his chair from work. And I was like, what's going on? And he said, we turned out the lights, the Food and Drug Administration. Like, Trump did not have anyone prepared to fill those roles. Mm-hmm. Like, there was literally no one minding the store that was the United States. And, I mean, one-third of State Department roles were not filled during his tenure. So when you say, like, what will happen with Trump, it's so hard to say because he's so fundamentally not in the business of government that it's almost hard to know what he can do. Like, he'll wreck things and he'll take revenge and he'll upend the legal system, and certainly America will take on a more fascist tinge. But, you know, he doesn't really care about the workings of government. He cares about his ratings, right? And that creates a whole different set of of problems and a whole different set of things to worry about than just if a monster came to power and really knew what they were doing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And let's talk briefly about President Biden in his present role. There seems to be a level of thinking that it's inevitable that he will not be re-elected for a second term. Would you agree with that?
Definitely not. No. I mean, one thing you have to recognize is that the poll, I don't put any polls in my book. Yeah. Because polls are not, they are literally
Thank
not
you.
Worth
it. Thank you.
They're like, I've never met a serious professional political organizer who thinks that they are worth anything, even the composite ones, even the ones where they try to make the math as sensible as possible. They are literally not worth anything. And you also have to remember, Americans haven't really started thinking about the next election yet. Like that'll come like 2-3 months from now. I don't think it really matters. Like we're in a position, like Biden could die. Like he's an 84-year-old man. It would not be a surprise if Joe Biden suddenly died. Right. And then we are in a position where it is inevitable that Trump could be defeated. But the problem is not necessarily this election cycle. It's that this country is so fragile that it literally is whether an 84-year-old man lives for a year.
Right.
Like,
okay.
That's the problem.
Based on that possibility that if he doesn't actually last until the end of his term, does that mean that Kamala Harris becomes the president in place?
Yes. If he died before the end of January 6th, 2025, then she would become president.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she is not a popular candidate, but I think the Democratic Party knows that. I mean, like, I think they've been aware of that for many years.
So succinctly put. One of the other five scenarios, a lone gunman assassinates a U.S. president. I was very interested, particularly in recent days, when you consider that an assassination attempt was made on Slovakian Prime Minister Robert Fico there.
Yes, indeed.
And one of the things I've read lately is that one of the forms of this civil war that you talk about, one of the shapes that it will take is it certainly won't be soldiers and horses galloping across empty fields, bearing weapons and bayonets. It will be neighbours turning on neighbours.
That's right.
And it will also be politicians being assassinated and gang warfare.
Yeah, I mean, chaos. Like, I mean, I think people imagine a civil war as gray coats and blue coats facing off of, I mean, even the new Civil War movie, right? Imagine like breakaway states. I mean, having read the book, I consider that basically impossible as a scenario, right? Like I think there is no model that I can follow where I can foresee, secessionist states going to war against each other. That just seems to me highly unlikely for a whole series of reasons. But chaos and sectarian violence and hyper-partisanship leading to, I mean, we are already in a state of deep tribalism. Mm-hmm. And for that tribalism to become violent, it would be really horrific, especially when you consider just how diverse America is. Yeah. Like, America is not, like, it is a place of, like, thousands of communities, of established communities, right? Like, it is a place of like, many, many different sides to it. Like when you think of what happened in Iraq or even in Syria, those are only they're fractious small communities, but they at first they were actually pretty sizable groups, and then they just shattered into these thousands and thousands of fragments at war with each other. And I mean that's sort of what the experts that I talk to would consider a much more likely scenario.
Mm. Now, in an interview you did shortly after the book was published, you said that America is very dry wood and all it's going to take is a spark to set something on fire. Now, the first I saw of that happening in real terms was January 6th, which was the attack in Washington, the storming of the Capitol.
What was your reaction when you saw that happening?
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, I think I was the only person alive that we really wasn't surprised. I mean, I had to kill a chapter of my book that had that exact scenario written out, yeah. Right? Like, I mean, so that was my actual response, was like, here's 60 pages gone. What I actually found surprising about it from a scholarly point of view or from my research was how disorganized it was, and also how it did not have, it was really unprepared for its own success. Mm-hmm. Like they had talked themselves into this, but they were not anywhere near as armed as I assumed they would be. And they were nowhere near as coherent as I thought they would be. The horrible thing to think is that this is sort of like the 1993 World Trade Center bombing.
Yeah.
Like a failure for various technical reasons. But the next time I doubt they will be as unprepared.
Yeah.
And they will also, of course, have, I mean, if they come again, they will have widespread political support this time. Mm. Right. They will have senators cheering them on. I mean, they almost did the first time. But like, you now have mainstream politicians really being unabashed about talking about January 6th, people convicted of January 6th crimes as political prisoners.
Right.
And like and having, you know, legitimate political coverage for this. So that, I mean, that would make it a lot more likely too. On the other hand, you know, you have to say that the FBI has taken the Biden years as a real opportunity to shut down a lot of far right groups, and they have actually done a very good job of that.
But when you take them from the top, aren't the levels beneath the top level, the most senior level, they're ready to take over? Isn't that the case?
The most senior level of the far right people?
Yeah. So in other words, you've
oh,
got.
Oh no no no
no
no. That would be, you'd be confusing them with people who have a plan.
Okay.
Like,
right.
You know, it's very important when talking about these people. Like, you know, like, I'm in Canada. There's a Quebec separatist movement that had a violent wing for a while.
Right.
They had absolutely serious intellectuals, very prepared, and political economists, and people with plans on how to run a separate country. They have. You know, they are absolutely, they mean it in a very, very clear way. These people are talking themselves into a froth on social media that then explodes into rage. They are not the anti-government patriot movement is extremely incoherent. I mean, I gave up describing it in the book. I mean, I just said, like, here's, you know, I mean, because if I were to describe it now, in 6 months, it would have changed.
Mm.
It's Christian nationalists, Second Amendment absolutists, sovereign citizens, neo-Nazis, Ku Klux Klan members, European identitarians, Boogaloo boys, you know, they all have different things, and they're all shifting all the time. But they should not be confused with a movement that has a hierarchical leadership that's capable of imposing some kind of order.
Right.
They're just chaos.
So they hate any form of establishment and government.
They believe, it's a very interesting thing, because I don't think it actually exists in any other country. They believe that the greatness of America is in resistance to its own government. Right.
Okay.
And I mean, this is the legacy of being a revolutionary people. Mm. Right. This is the legacy. You know, you see similar things in other governments founded by militia members.
Mm.
Right. Like in Algeria, for instance, it has the same essential problem, is that, you know, once you've begun by overthrowing the political order, it seems very natural for that to be something that happens again and again. I mean, that's what the Second Civil War was. It was another declaration of independence. Right. And, you know, someone else will definitely make another Declaration of Independence in the United States, for sure.
Right. I read a statistic many, many years back where 40% of Americans, first of all, don't have a passport. I think 50% of Americans have never left their own state where they were born.
Yeah, that's true, too. I wonder what that number would be in Ireland.
Well, certainly.
I'm curious. I genuinely don't know. I genuinely don't know.
That's a very good question, actually.
I think a lot of people don't leave where they were born. I think that's a lot. I mean, you know, I would also say that in America, America is so huge and diverse that it's kind of it. I mean, it's really many, many countries in one. I mean, it's sort of like saying you only stayed in Europe. Like if you're in, you know, California, the difference between that and Florida and Florida and Idaho and Maine are just so, I mean, they, you know, they sometimes they can't even really get each other's dialects. They can't really understand how each other speaks, right? Well, yeah. And so it's like I don't know. I've always, you know, people have always taken that stat as like a sign of insularism. But I mean, if there were one country that you could not leave, it would be America, right? Because you can see deserts and you can see rainforests and you can see major cities and you can see snow and mountains and everything. It's all, it really is a huge country.
Yeah. Just coming back to the five scenarios, which is at the heart of the book, and you work, you beautifully work your way around each of these scenarios and you bring it into the main theme of the conversation. You talk about a major climate catastrophe which plunges New York into chaos. That's unimaginable, but it's not impossible.
When people ask me what's the most likely scenario in the book, that is the one.
Right.
Because the environmental models are the strongest models, like by far. Like economic models are basically not worth the paper they're printed on. But environmental models have a really strong track record. And I mean, the guy I talked to about that was a reinsurer. And reinsurers are people who insure insurance companies. I mean, literally $1 trillion bets are made on this guy's models, right? And he thinks that New York is super, super vulnerable to a hurricane. I mean, it's not just that it's vulnerable, like hurricanes are going to hit it, but it's also the amount of infrastructure that is in every square kilometer of Manhattan under that schist is so intense that repairing it would be, it's considered one of the uninsurable losses, the other one being Tokyo, just because this, like, if an earthquake hits Tokyo, it cannot properly be insured, right? It's just too much value damaged at one time, compared to the rest of the scope of the world, right? And a similar thing could absolutely happen in New York. And I mean, if you were to ask me what's the most likely scenario to actually happen, that's the one that has the strongest model for sure, a hurricane hitting New York. And they've done almost nothing to protect against it. I hear they're starting to build the wall again, but I hope it is, I hope it is not too little too late.
Yeah, and you're saying that this climate catastrophe, which plunges New York into chaos, that could be the tipping point for civil war.
Well, I mean, the model that I used from the internal displacement people, I mean, again, you know, these are all taken from, like, it's not really my insight. It's like what the best thing I could find. But they estimated that by 2050, there would be 11 million environmental internal refugees in the United States alone. Mm. So those internal refugee numbers have huge, like, they're what they call I'm forgetting the word that the CIA uses for events that cause things to spiral out of control. There's a technical term for it. I've forgotten. Mm-hmm. But if you think about, like, drought happens in Honduras, this leads to huge numbers of farmers having no choice but to flee. They flee north. That creates a border crisis at the United States. That border crisis leads in part to Trump being elected. Trump makes a series of very terrible decisions that make America more vulnerable to environmental catastrophe. You see how this builds on itself, right? It's like a loop, a complex cascading system, as they call it. And those sorts of subtle effects are just so, I think what I was most proud of in the book is that I tried to register those because they're so powerful and you can't really see them. It's not like you can debate them with people. Like, it's like they're just sort of there.
Yeah. There are 400 million guns in America. Now, if we're at that point where there's a very strong possibility that let's say we've moved beyond the point of civil unrest and the next stage is civil war, there's not a lot of damage limitation that can be put in place if there are 400 million guns loose in America.
No, no. I mean, it's a, well, it's interesting because there's sort of two takes on it. I mean, one is that with, you know, when you go to these gun shows like I did, you know, you see these guys and they explicitly talk about having guns to resist federal authority and, you know, breakdowns in society. And then the government will come to take your property and you have to fight them. And, you know, they fully indulge in all these fantasies. But the truth is, like, the Marines are the Marines. Like, sending professional, I mean, I remember going to one of these prepper conventions where they were in this room talking about, like, you know, how to have a bug out bag and all these like abstruse military terms and stuff like that. And I was like, you know, I don't know what a fight against, I don't know what combat looks like, but I'm pretty sure you need to be able to run a mile and nobody in this room can run a mile. Like, I don't know what you think it's going to be like to take on the US Marines, but I'm pretty sure you need to be able to run a mile to do it. And none of you can. I mean, so, you know, the US Marines are just, you know, they have missiles. You know, and I mean, you know, I wanted in the first one to have a battle scene. And I talked to all these different military experts and they were like, there would be no battle. We would turn off the water and we would. But on the other hand, you know, they would win every battle. But these wars of partisanship, they're unwinnable. I mean, they are just like they tried in Afghanistan. They tried in Iraq. They tried in Syria. They tried in Algeria. They tried in Vietnam. Like the counterinsurgency manual of the United States, it currently boils down to basically don't.
Yeah.
Don't get in. Don't start. Do not do this.
Yeah.
Like it's not winnable. Right. And there's no good outcome. And I think, you know, trying to get the people of America to be obedient, like setting up your cities with Alaska gates like they did in Baghdad. I mean, it just wouldn't fly. Like they're not the people to do that to.
Yeah. One of the lines that just instantly caught my attention, you say, when marriages get to the state the US is in, people get a divorce before the other option is just too ugly. It's just, it's perfect, isn't it, in its descriptive sense. Now, just coming back to that statistic of the 40% of Americans who think we're on the verge of a civil war in the United States, many of them are saying that it will happen before 2030. Would you agree with that?
No, look, I don't know. You know, the number I had when I wrote the book in my head was 2040, right? Because a bunch of things happen in 2040 in the environmental models, but then also that's when white people in the United States become a majority minority. It becomes a majority minority country.
Yeah.
The white people are not the dominant ethnicity anymore. Wherever that happens in the world, that leads to ethnic violence, like all over Africa, South America, Europe, wherever that happens, there's violence. So the number I had in my head was 2040. But, you know, I don't really want, I know it's funny to say, because obviously it's a book of predictions, and like, but it's, I don't really actually want to predict. I just want to show the models.
Yeah.
Because I think, like if you look at the models and look at them carefully and read them accurately, you don't need to fantasize or pick a date. You know, the question just becomes like, how do we get off this particular train ride? You know, that's what I would hope. But, you know, as we said at the beginning, like I think there is actually some appetite for this violence, naive as that is.
Yeah, but we're moving into a, what could you call it? A new world normalization. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think I the only objection I would have to that phrase is that I don't think there will be no normalization.
Right.
Right. Like it will be an era of denormalization. It'll be an era where, you know, like I think when you look at what's happening in Haiti, for instance, where like the most powerful man in the world is a man, and the most powerful man in the country is a man named Barbecue. Right. Like. And it's just simply gangland chaos, and no one is going to step in, right? Like no one. They've decided that military intervention is more trouble than it's worth, and you have these pockets of chaos spreading all over the world. Yemen, yeah. I mean, I you know, I think what I was describing in America is just very vulnerable to it because it is so fast and so smart and I mean, ironically, right? But like, because it is so so on the cutting edge of things, it feels these things first. But I mean, I really think it's coming for everywhere.
Yeah. I think if Trump gets back in, he may call you to ask you to be his Secretary of Future Forecasting. how would you feel about that?
Well, no, I spoke to government agencies all the time in the United States, right? I mean, they are not unaware of this problem, right? Like they're I've done talks for all kinds of classes. It's